And this is Lena Live. I'm Lena Miermont. I'm starting my program a little late because indeed we have some technical problems to reach a very special guest whose name is Michael Johnson. He is living in France, and I hope that eventually we will conquer the distance. We will cross the ocean by internet or telephone or whatever it will take to bring Michael Johnson to our conversation. But meanwhile, I like to start this extremely special program because this gentleman truly presents a challenge to be described. In fact, I hope that eventually if he will join us, he will help me to give a proper presentation of who he is. And the reason I honestly admit in failing to describe him in the best way is because he literally doesn't have any borders as a writer, as a historian, of course, as a journalist, but mostly important as a thinker and visionary. He writes for a number of distinguished journals, some newspaper, including New York Times, International Tribune. He does write regularly for some magazines like American's Spectacle, and I would say he is not afraid to be skeptical, writing his articles on absolutely various subjects. And that's the last one which allowed me to discover him because, frankly, I was truly amazed by certain observation and analysis of this writer who was extremely devoted and dedicated to write about music, specifically about piano performance, and to be even more specific about piano competitions. So that prompted me to see more of his writing and get more acquainted with him, and I did. And that finally brought me to actually a fantastic discovery of a number of his books, one of which is French Resistance. And that book is true opening to not only French culture, French traditions, French business climate, but it also opens one's ideas and concerns. What does it take to merge with a new and a different culture? I hope that Michael, as I mentioned before, would be able to join us because he's life is so incredibly interesting, unusual, and unpredictable. He started as absolutely classic American, spending his many years being American and learning all layers and levels of American society. But then he was creatively restless and just to summarize in a nutshell, I would say that his presence in Russia and in France and in England were very far away from being just a tourist. He truly merged with the society. He spent there for, in each country, he spent a fair amount of time to have this taste of not only everyday life and common things to experience, but he really went into the depths of thinking and participating in every society he was living in. So I would certainly say that among very many noble and talented writers who are taking an intellectual risk, who are going sometimes against expectations or some would say successful and predictably well-recognized writing, he would take a chance. He would express himself. He would be very brave, to say the least, honest. And the most important, he was very loyal to himself, and he still is. The reason I choose to make a focal point of French Resistance, because in his own words, I understand that he feels that this is one of his best writing. I like to hope that we will be able to solve this technical issue, and I'm going to have a little musical interval here, because I hope that I gave somewhat more than a flavor of this remarkable person. And then I will be continuing with more on his book and with more on my own thoughts. So that is my usual musical little break. And to remind you that I'm going to continue speaking with my tremendous enthusiasm about Michael Johnson, who we all eagerly to waiting and looking forward to welcome to our program. Doesn't look as if we are successful to bring Michael to our program. So I would suggest that we're going to continue talking about him for a little while, and then hopefully by next time we will solve the issue and we'll be more successful in this connection. I'm partly disappointed because in one sense, even this digital world is failing us, even though we are enjoying convenience of it. But I feel that it will be certainly much more fulfilling if Michael will be present, and if not only will hear his voice, but his thoughts, and the mostly important, his own ideas about our society. That's what really grabbed me about his way and the way he expressed the issues of human challenges using French resistance experience. And I am very eager to let him express his own extension to this book. And I also feel that reading this book is more just reading another fantastic philosophical and very practical perception of French environment, but it also opens a lot of issues to, frankly, every society. And the most important, it opens the door for, if not solving, but approaching such a sensitive issue as a change and connection. Those words we're using so often, we are living change every second, but some of them natural and some of them very, very far from being natural. So that's where our intellect and our courage kicks in. And those points are brilliantly expressed by Mr. Johnson in his book. And frankly, not only in this book, in his articles as well, I'm trying to be almost very cautious and not to talk too much about his book, because I truly feel that it is only fair for the author to comment on his own work, and it is fair for us to know his own points of view. Listeners had to take my introduction, which I honestly said only partly can satisfy eagerly awaiting your audience, and I will say in a nutshell what I have expressed, and then we will start to sail, giving you full time airtime.
Okay.
So what?
Well, tell me when we are on the air. We're not on the air now, are we?
Yes, actually, we are on the air now.
Okay.
However, I have to say that it is not 100%, but it looks as if we are on the air. And I think I have a confirmation from both sides, from the radio and locally here. So we are on the air. We can breathe very fresh air. I heard airtime is the freshest in the world today. Well, I tell you what I said about you. I said that among very distinguished authors, journalists, historians, thinkers, and visionaries, you are one of the most unique, talented, intellectually and emotionally brave visionary who experienced very fully living in different society, and that you open a door to something which many people would be cautious to open and simply will be afraid to talk about. And that is differences, changes, and connections, which people sometimes forced to make during their lifetimes. And I did mention absolutely endless diversification of your work, where I literally was drowned in reading about mentality of suburban housewives, and then I was truly not noticing how I end up reading about piano music and piano competitions and even idiosyncrasies of piano interpretations. Then somehow I found myself in a very eloquent woods of your article about Woody Allen and perception of Paris. So after this initial journey, I could not resist for the good reason. And after we made initial contact, you shared with me your personal opinion about your best book, French Resistance, which indeed became, at least for a short period of time, one of the best books in the house.
Oh, I'm flattered.
And I have to describe my relationship with the book, because when it arrived, I was marveled the beautiful, aesthetically well arranged the cover. But then I, frankly, was so happy to go beyond the cover. And, of course, your drawings made this that much more expressive, that much more memorable. In fact, I didn't even mention that you're not only friendly with the words, you are very friendly with a pencil.
Yes, I always have been. I'm probably in a previous life, Lena, I was an artist, or maybe a pianist. I like to think I might have been Franz Liszt.
Well, that's not a bad connection. Well, I would say that I happily feel that I'm failing to make a proper introduction, and I'm failing for the good reason. Because there are only few who can truly be at home with so many subjects. And I have to say that I did read your book probably on the three levels, as a European, as a foreigner, and partly as an American. And all those levels were incredibly nourished with so much information, so much philosophical and practical avenues. So I think I like to stop talking here and open all gates to you. The only little thing I would like to say, that if you do not mind, I like to have somewhat title for our program, which would be called Union of Opposites. We will not go into any fancy dialectic in a philosophy, but some of it are so critically important in our global society issues and problems. So if you do not mind, because of the complexity of your writing, and yet very crisp and transparent style of your writing, I like to just to have a little spark of the complexity by asking you perhaps a few questions regarding that union of opposites. How did you manage to make such extraordinary shift from being classic American, as I introduced you in the very beginning, and ending up drinking French wine?
Well, I will try to explain. I knew at a young age, well, around 18 or 19, that I wanted to be a foreign correspondent. So I instinctively understood that to achieve this goal, I would need to speak at least two foreign languages. So at university level, I first studied and did pretty well in the French class, and then I decided to climb a bigger mountain, so I started studying Russian And this strategy worked very well for me because at a young age, I was in Moscow as a correspondent, and a few years later, I was in Paris as a correspondent. So my moves around the globe were all connected with my skills as a journalist, and eventually I decided to move to Bordeaux, where I am now, and that was a very smart thing to do. I must add that in the middle of all this moving around, I decided to take the biggest risk of my life. I accepted an offer to become the editor of a magazine in France, in the French language. And the reason I said yes to that offer, Lena, is because I knew so many Americans that talked about their opinions of other cultures and other languages, and talked about their vacations in France or Italy, or even in what we used to call Leningrad. Americans traveled rather eagerly to have a quick, superficial look at the world. And I understood that superficial was the important word in that sentence. And I wanted to see what it would really be like to live in France and live on the French economy and behave within French employment law and try to make a career as a French person. I even bought a beret. I wore a beret. And my poor mother, she was already passed on by then, but she was a country girl from Indiana, and I think she probably would have been horrified if she ever knew that I secretly dreamed of being so bicultural that the French people would think I was French. Well, I'm pretty close to that, but after a few minutes of chit-chat, they can always pick up a little bit of an accent. So I nearly accomplished my aim, and I wrote a book about my experience of living on the French economy.
The book is so borderless, because even though it is about your experience in France, but frankly, this is very modest estimation of yours. When I was reading this book, I had to make so many stops, have a dialogue with my own thinking, and it was just a tremendous arena for connections, for comparison. I mean, this book, I hate to say this well-established American expression as a wake-up call. I will make it perhaps a little bit more appropriate to the meaning of your book. It's a wake-up mind, because it is truly way beyond just your experience in France. I like to express a little bit of my frustration and perhaps to make you feel less frustrated, because indeed it was frustrating for me to group thoughts for just one program. So, and not to make it too shallow, not to make it too focused and to deprive some other sections and facets of your book. So I will ask somewhat forgiveness in advance if we just will touch only some of the aspects and thoughts of your book, because there is constant collaboration between relatively simple things to understand, but then it goes into quite in depth with the emotional collisions, with some intellectual, almost intellectual fights, and a lot of unsuccessful resistance. So I just like to ask you if you will allow us to be somewhat flexible, a little jumpy, but ultimately to have a fair observation, at least preliminary observation, of this absolutely outstanding work of yours. I would start as a student with the preface, and by the way, I have to tell you, once I started to read your book, I started to develop some linguistic dreams, because the vocabulary of your language is quite challenging, not only for understanding, but even for pronunciation. So when I would not understand a word, and I would say, if I will go to dictionary, and dictionary would give somewhat mechanical translation, and then I have to make a sculpture it to your thought, that was a process in itself. So I like to start right from the preface, where you're describing France as a homogenized and conformist and integrated with the rest of the world society, with a very negative mark to it. Can you explain this?
Yes, France for a very, very long time has always felt that it had a special role in the world, a special message to the world, a special way of life. And therefore, it has always been difficult for French people to integrate when they try to live abroad, for example. And this has a good side and a bad side. Because the good side is, when you come to France, you're seeing very concentrated French thinking, French ideas, French behavior. Everything is really very, very French here. Whereas if you go to New York, the movement of peoples from all over the world seem to converge on New York. And so you have, for example, a lot of Russians in New York. You have a lot of Italians. You have a lot of black people. You have a lot of Asians. This is not true in France. Almost everybody in France has a French name and lives very much by the French rules. So it was quite a shock at first, and then I realized the only way to survive was to be like them. So I didn't exactly carry a baguette under my arm or ride a bicycle. That's the cliche picture of a French person. But I just submerged myself in the culture, and that gave me some sleepless nights, but it also gave me some wonderful material for comparing cultures and showing the world how different it is to come here and live the life as compared to coming here and being on vacation. And those are two totally separate worlds. I still have a lot of visitors here in Bordeaux who stay with me for a few days and ask me, well, why does everybody talk about a crisis in the French economy? I don't see any crisis. Well, you don't see it on the surface. But believe me, if you're working in a French company, you see it right away. And especially in the past 5 years, as President Sarkozy has been trying to toughen the French worker and make him and her believe that if you work harder, you will make more money and have a better life. That is a message that Americans are very accustomed to, but the French have found that very difficult to swallow, and therefore Sarkozy finds himself, if I may be very topical for a minute, he finds himself in very serious difficulty as he tries to win a second five-year term, and he's facing elections in April. By all appearances today, he is not going to win. So he's been trying to change France, to make France more like the United States, as a matter of fact. And the French people are not buying it. So I love cultural comparisons. And they're not always easy to to make and to back up and to be certain of. So it's a long-term objective, and I think I got it just about right in my book, French Resistance. But maybe the proof of that is the French don't really like this book.
Well, I'm surprised that they sell you wine still after that book. But I'm glad that happening. Michael, I'd like to dig a little bit into your comparison between French society and that diversification of American society, and perhaps Americans would not like what I'm going to say. This kaleidoscopic, very popular and almost seductive picture of American multinational and multicultural land can be very deceptive. And especially after this huge historic event, and if I will forgive myself for taking a little bit of a time, taking advantage of your intellectual criticism of what I'm going to say, I'd like to make my point by going back a little bit. For relatively a short period of time, the world had to face collapse of communism, a very aggressive birth of terrorism. All of this collided with a modern living, with the technology. The religious wars became so incredibly harsh, almost 3 or 4 times more of countries who have now nuclear weapons. But there is one thing which is missing. It's intellectual, emotional, and human communication. And even though there is indeed a very healthy on the surface collection of various cultures and nationalities in the United States, but it is not always really what it is, because the only reason they coexisting is a dollar value. It is economically driven society where indeed has its own rules, its own official regulations. There is hierarchy in political organizations, and it has its own dark and very painful for unstandard elements. So I would say that what you described in your book is quite fantastic resonance of what people experiencing in this country. So let me ask you, to what extent you would agree with me, and if you disagree, I would be even more interested in that. Air is yours.
Well, I certainly agree that the United States is economically driven. That is, the culture of the American is to earn more money and constantly climb the ladder, even when you are high enough to be comfortable. One is almost compulsively pushing to earn more, have more money in the bank, spend more money. It's the consumer society is shocking to a European who comes back for a visit to the United States, or even to me. In fact, every time I come back to the States, I write an article of some kind about what shocked me most this time. And I always have an embarrassment of riches trying to find examples of how differently the Americans live, how wasteful they are, how this economic drive leads to a life without a spiritual side. Now, this is something the Europeans have gained on the Americans. The Europeans, especially the French, but also I would say all of Latin Europe, that is Southern Europe, believes that quality of life is separate from getting rich. And that explains, of course, why they tend to be less productive than the United States also. And they are, as you probably know, half a dozen of the European countries are in very, very sad economic shape because the American drive for more and more has actually been beneficial to them in this world of globalization. And the Europeans have not really benefited, at least the Southern Europeans have not benefited because they try to balance economic gain with quality of life. I was always struck by the French who close their businesses for 2 hours for lunch in the winter and 3 or 4 hours for lunch in the summer. And visitors who observe this always ask me how could this be? They could earn so much more money if they worked through the lunch hour. Well, that's an argument that a French person just can't handle. This had interesting repercussions in the management of a French company also. The French can't wait to get out of the office and go somewhere else and start their real life every day. That is, they work because they have to, because they have to eat and they have to have at least a livable wage. But their heart very often is not in their work. Their real life is outside. In fact, their real friends are outside. American companies try to encourage the men and women who work together to establish connections on an emotional, personal basis. There are parties, often Friday afternoon parties with, dare I say, alcoholic beverages available, and love affairs are common. Even IBM used to have a rule that it was considered to be illegal in IBM to make love on company time or company furniture.
Well, what is the suspicious knowledge you have? and you so well informed what's going on in U.S. living in France. I'm wondering, what are your activities in France right around your nose?
Well, I didn't really enjoy the 2 years that I spent running the magazine that I was editing, although it was sort of reminded me, Lena, of the time that I spent in Moscow. I didn't really enjoy that either, but it was never boring because every day something unbelievable was happening, and I was taking notes. So in France, I really found happiness when I came back here 5 years ago to work as a freelance writer and selling most of my work back in the United States or outside of the French network that I'm part of. So I have it both ways now. I'm enjoying the soft side of French life, but I really make my living, well, partly by pensions, but also partly by selling my material to the American newspaper, the Herald Tribune, which, as you probably know, is the now known as the global edition of the New York Times, and also to American Spectator, which is a marvelous, slightly conservative, but well-written magazine and daily online newspaper, and finally to the Washington Times also. So those three main outlets are all American-owned. So my economic side is American, but my pleasure side and my choice of what I write about is more influenced by the French. So I've become deeply involved in some of the French legacy from the 18th century and beyond. I'm writing a script right now for a one-man show of Voltaire's time in London. Voltaire was a bad boy in the eyes of the monarchy when he was writing. So at one point he was expelled from France and lived for a couple of years in London and then made many waves while I was in London. So there's a tremendous additional attraction to me in France. The history and the literature of the past, which simply does not exist in the United States. While Versailles was filled with great music and glamour and glitter, the Americans were fighting the Indians and trying to collect arrowheads and sometimes scalps. So the American history story is extremely shallow compared to what we have in France, and it's an endless effort to try to master all of what France has achieved in 8 or 9 centuries. So that, as a writer and a reader, I find constant stimulation. The even my neighbors are quite erudite and educated, so it's part of their culture to be raised. Assuming we're talking about the educated classes here, mastering their own history, and they constantly refer to it. They live in the reflected light of the last few centuries, whereas Americans hardly know what happened yesterday.
Oh, I'm not sure they will sell you a ticket next time you want to come to America, but but you have your friends here anyhow. I could to pick up on one thought which happened to be very sensitive to myself or to anyone who artistically or musically oriented. One of many chapters, by the way, your book is so beautifully organized. It is, even though I was complimented you with your vocabulary, which was a challenge in itself. But on the side of that, your chapters are just very well planned, and I would say receptivity of your ideas flowing very lovely. I would say that this book became like a school book for myself, filled with notes, so it's not as beautifully polished a new manuscript the way it's came. It became like a music score with notes and ideas and so forth. So
you don't tell me you were singing the chapters one after another.
It didn't come to that, but the thoughts being somewhat dancing in a duet or trio or quartet or sometimes quintet. There is a chapter on reason ascending, and very beautifully you wrote, actually, about incredible almost necessity for French to be connected to spiritualism, and almost like a part of their integral life. And I found this in somewhat contradiction, and complexity comes here right away, where you're also describing something which has to do with their separation in between private and public, or to say private and business life. That is something which is so hard to achieve, and it is endless discussion in itself. But I like for you to make a parallel where, in one sense, they are sensitive to such a strong power of spiritualism. And it's not, I'm not talking about the religious ideas or religious fanatical orientation. I'm talking about this emotional, aesthetic, spiritual desire, which they experience more than, I believe you said, Anglo-Saxonian people, or if I'm not very accurate, you're definitely emphasizing that French are more expressive on this, with their dreams, with their ideas than some other nations. So how come they are extremely restrictive in sharing their personalities on a personal level, even with their colleagues? How come they are so fearful of that?
I've often thought about this question myself, Lena, and I think I know the answer. Their history has been rather violent. If you look back a few hundred years, lots of terrible wars, some civil and some with neighboring countries. And that has bred an attitude of suspicion in the country. Suspicion about people that you don't know very well. And they close the door to close relations with strangers and rely instead on friends that they have known almost all of their life. That is, friends from childhood. That's where they get their personal satisfaction. But you'll never find, you'll very rarely find French people being friendly with each other in a really personal way within the company. I remember, I think I have this in the book, an American woman that I knew in Paris working for a different company was explaining how difficult it was for her to understand this problem. And she said, for example, at the end of the day, every day, the French colleague that you've been sitting right next to all day, and helping and sharing the business problem with, will put on her hat and coat and turn to you and say, au revoir, à demain. In other words, goodbye, see you tomorrow. And she really means it. She won't see you until tomorrow because she has her own life outside the company and you are not part of it.
You know, it just happened. It's not that I'm such a diligent student. I'm really not. But that is on your page 49, what you just described. It's just a lucky coincidence that I did remember this example. I was very much impressed by this example. And it's in chapter Touching and Feeling. Frankly, when I saw this title, I thought, this is something very interesting to be here. However, again, you've been describing actually very profound social traditions, mental and psychological intentions. I have to say that there is a certain similarity in United States. And let us go a little bit away from your book just for one second, because this is one of those sharp examples when I was traveling away with my thoughts, with my own humble experiences, and watching some other people's journey. This separation and lack of natural exchange presents itself in my mind in a great conflict. And I tell you exactly what I mean. For example, it's a well-known fact. I'm sorry, I take this back. It's not a well-known fact for people who were not living in the totalitarian regime, but for people who used to live in the totalitarian regime, know that family is very close. For example, communal living where five families will be living, having only one kitchen, inevitably will know all details about their lives. In fact, there was such a tremendous stress, which no one discussed, because that was the way people been living. And it's not because they were poor or uneducated. In fact, number of great people, for example, like Rostropovich, who used to live like this, and there are many others. The point I'm trying to make that it is a tremendous contradiction, which I mentioned before, union of opposites, where very dictatorial, cruel, stiff regime yet does not stop people or maybe even suggest to people to have this closeness because they don't have any other ways of emotional and human survival. So the friendships and devotion and shake hands agreement would be the way to go. No banks, no contracts, none of this aggressive capitalistic mentality was known to human race, in fact, on those grounds. So where in the United States, which is the strongest example of capitalistic life, there is a separation. People living in condominium buildings, they don't even know each other's name. And in the offices, because of the competition and this dress code for success, makes people indeed pull away from each other. Needless to say, after September 11, it became so incredibly strong. Fear, stress, stiffness is the most popular psychological disease in today's world. So I would take a little issue here where you're describing French mentality so clearly, and it's very naturally, but I would not say that it's only a situation with French.
Well, I think it can be explained when you understand that the American, typical American's life is built around work, and therefore most of the friends come from the workplace, not from your next door neighbor. And you're quite right to say, especially in the big cities, people in apartment buildings or condos rarely connect with their immediate neighbors, but they very much connect with their fellow workers. And that's where the personal emotional satisfaction comes from. So that's a wonderful contrast with the French way. Where the French have actually a double life. They have a work life that is that exists only to feed them, and they have a very rich personal life with lifelong friends. And the two coexist. And we, coming from America, we have a lot of trouble seeing how this works. But it does work, and it's a firm pillar of the of French society. They simply need they need to retain their childhood friendships. I didn't quite finish when you asked me why they are. I believe you asked something about why they are suspicious of each other, or I was trying to explain that. Some of the French writers have tried to tackle this story too, and I just happen to have this same book in front of me, Lena, and one of my favorite quotes. I started every chapter with a quote, chapter two starts with a quote. I'll just read it here. It's only one sentence. It comes from Pierre Daninos, who was a very well-known writer and kind of humorist in the 1940s and 50s. Okay, here's what he says. The Frenchman is suspicious. Could I go so far as to say that he is born suspicious, grows up suspicious, marries suspicious, goes to work suspicious, and dies suspicious? I think I could. So I'm not making this up, Lena. This is the kind of barrier that is not easily overcome. There is an inbuilt hesitation to share knowledge or share any heartfelt emotion with people that you don't know very well.
Well, I frankly subscribe to that. And I do remember this quote, and I found this philosophically somewhat humorous. You know, some Eastern European come to America and they make fun of American superficial optimism, saying that I'm dying fine. I'm dying, but I'm still fine.
I see.
You know, it's a certain very interesting psychological cliches and psychological almost disposition, the total unshakable. I like to bring another point in one of your in your chapters about privacy. Don't ask me where I live.
Yes.
Really? I'll stop there. Please go on.
Yes, I think you're referring to a woman who worked for me, and I still vividly remember driving her from the workplace across Paris to drop her off because we were both working quite late. And she was a typical French woman. She did not want me to know where she lived. So she actually asked me to drive her toward Montmartre, where she was living, somewhere in the Montmartre area. And she asked me to drop her at the Père Lachaise Cemetery. And it was midnight. And she didn't mind at all walking past or through, I don't know, this rather spooky cemetery, because it was one way of stopping me from knowing where she lived. I found that really strange, and it's just one of many quirks that any study of comparative cultures will reveal. Attitudes toward strangers.
Yes, but this one, frankly, had to do with I believe freshly arrived to Paris, the president of the American company's French office, who wanted to create a welcome home party or something like that.
Yes, he was newly appointed, and he wanted to be friends with the people he was working with. He was an American. Unfortunately, nobody had educated him on the differences between the two cultures. So, yes, he invited virtually the whole company to come to his big house on a Sunday afternoon for food and drink. And this created an earthquake in the company. They just couldn't handle it, but they couldn't say no because it was the boss who was inviting them. So the men and women turned up with their spouses, and this was extremely uncomfortable to them because they didn't want their colleagues to know what kind of person they were married to. This was really getting into personal areas that they like to keep extremely private. So I still remember this man telling me the story about how he observed these poor people suffering as they ate his food and drank his wine, I must add, trying to avoid bumping into each other and moving along the wall to avoid being surrounded by somebody else's wives. And he only had to do it once to realize that it was a terrible mistake. And I think it was one of his colleagues who took him aside after the party and said, this was not a very good idea. He really shouldn't do it again.
Which is really an extreme. I'd like to jump back to your introduction, and I tell you why. This introduction, actually, I had to study, and I reread it, because I think you making a point, again, using your French experience, but this is truly a global experience, because you bring in a number of occasions from different corners the idea of accepting another culture, the idea of opening your mind and understand that you already preconditioned, I think that's the word you're using, that you are preconditioned and it is already very unnatural. And it is. It does take effort, and it does take a certain amount of perseverance to understand, and if not agree, but to respect another culture. We are living in a world environment when perhaps this is my very personal subjective feeling, where we are forced to think out of the box. I personally. I'm going to express some very controversial thought that I was very cautious when Europe decided to reunite and to reunite its forces and to become as one, because this is such a collision, not only cultural traditions, but psychological adaptation. And especially when communism fell and many people just lost their homes, and it was a tremendous, colossal chaos, which is still trying to find its barometer for function, that's where the world started to really be challenged, and people became spiritually homeless. I found that your introduction is very much expressing this challenge. And I wanted to congratulate you, because being an American, and Americans like to be in comfort zone, and when they go to France, they like to see continuation of America rather than to face and to be challenged by a foreign culture. You were able not only to merge with another society, but I'm wondering at what cost. What was the most critically emotionally difficult for you? Where did you find your most heartful inspiration to talk about this, which is stunningly expressed in French Resistance?
Well, the first thing I had to accept, Leona, was that, and this is my own observation, I didn't learn this in a book, but I came to the conclusion that when two people from different cultures are find themselves together, the person who has to adapt more is the visitor in the other culture. So I was the visitor in France. So I've realized I could not make my colleagues like me. I had to make myself like them. And yes, it was difficult, but that's why I accepted the job. I wanted to go through that cleansing process. It's almost like getting rid of the brainwashing that you had by growing up in one culture. And I wanted to clean my brain out and try a completely different culture. And that, as you indicate, that's what triggered the book. All the experiences I had along the way. So you're asking what was the most difficult thing to do? There are so many. Where should I start? I think probably the most difficult is the opposite way that people interact compared to the U.S. The expression is in the U.S., people's interests in each other are a mile wide and an inch deep. While in France, people's interest in each other is a mile deep, but an inch wide. So this you can argue both sides of this. There are pros and cons on both sides. I happen to, if you force me to admit which I prefer, I have to say I prefer the American way, because by opening yourself to so many experiences and people, you have a much wider choice of how your friendships and your personal life is going to develop. So the French intentionally shut themselves off to many experiences because of this history they have of mutual suspicion and their determination to stick with people they know and have known for a very long time. So a mile wide and an inch deep is America. A mile deep and an inch wide is France. That's one of the biggest contrasts and one of the most difficult things to accept because it affects your daily life. It affects every minute of your daily life.
This is truly a comprehensive answer. Michael, I suggest that we will have just a little break. I traditionally have this when particularly very substantial thought is expressed, and I think this is one of those moments in this very special program I'm having with Michael Johnson, whose work, French Resistance, became a precious subject for discussion, for thinking, and for an inspiration for many other works, not only for him as a writer and historian and journalist, but for many others who had such an incredible connection with his work. We're going to make a little break, and then we will continue our discussion, and hopefully Michael will catch his a little rest and will be recharged.
Thank you.
Continuation. And we continue after this very sweet note, a music part. We're coming back to our verbal notes. My guest is Michael Johnson, who kindly found his moments of participating in our conversation all the way from France, Bordeaux. And we are talking about many issues which are rotating around his French Resistance book, which is also filled with absolutely fantastically humorous drawings. Michael, I certainly did not acknowledge one quality of your book as a humor. I took this book so seriously that I frankly did acknowledge humor, but that was somewhat secondary. But let's talk about humor. Your drawings, obviously, I cannot characterize fully over the radio. However, let me try. Let me try. That's already funny. The drawings is a fantastic continuation of your verbal ideas. And I found that they jump in very unexpectedly. In fact, I didn't have enough of it. But where I had it, it was remarkable. Let's talk about your artistry. You said that perhaps you felt that you should be an artist or the pianist. Will come to your piano abilities in a few minutes. But let's talk about these drawings. And how do you correlate words and image? Maybe sometimes drawings provokes certain full expressions.
I think it's the other way around, Lena. I wrote the book first and then went back over it page by page looking for situations that lend themselves to a line drawing. And I think I have, I don't think I've counted them. There must be 10 or 12 drawings that are essentially cartoons, but they're very carefully tied to something written on the same page. So sometimes it was a, well, often those drawings were actually situations in the workplace that I experienced. So I wanted to make a special point to illuminate and put the spotlight on some of those situations, and the drawing was a good way to do it, because if the eye is instinctively drawn to the artwork before the words. So one of my favorite experiences, one of my favorite anecdotes that was a bad experience, actually, I turned into a cartoon that shows a worker talking to his boss. I drew myself as the boss because this really happened. And one of my workers said something like, I won't take any initiative. I will only do what you tell me to do, and then I'll decide if I want to do it. So it seemed like such a roundabout contortion of an attitude toward the workplace. They want to be told what to do, and then they'll do it if they feel like it. So that's what it was. That's what management in France was all about. It was very, very much. Oh, here's the drawing. The caption is, "Here's the deal. You tell me exactly what you want me to do, and I'll do it if I feel like it." So you can see if somebody who comes from an American management situation is accustomed to being, well, I shouldn't use the word obeyed, but is accustomed to if he wants to keep his job, he does what the boss tells him to do, and does it happily, and does it quickly, and does it as well as possible. Well, the French worker prides himself on what he will call his individualism. And that's another strain that runs through French culture. The typical French person is very proud of his individuality and will go to great lengths to protect it. And this, it all goes wrong when the individuality crosses over into egotism. So instead of just being an individual, you become very selfish. And that is extremely hard to manage. And so you end up, I had 75 people under my so-called command. And I kept thinking of the American expression, it was like trying to herd cats. It's like having 75 cats and you're trying to lead them to go somewhere. Well, the cats don't pay any attention to the leader. Well, so it was a very, very hard nut to crack. And I'm not sure I even managed to crack it. I had good comments from people after I left the company, but I didn't feel, here's the truth, I didn't really feel I was ever going to be happy with that kind of rather sloppy management. It's inefficient. So productivity is way below what it should be. And as I said earlier in the program, the French economy suffers from this strange attitude of not wanting to do what the company wants, but to do what I want. You see, it's a legitimate philosophical split. But if your economy is suffering and your company is suffering, this is not the time to be selfishly individualistic. It's time to work with the company, because if the company does well, you will do well. But I'm sorry to say that is not an argument that goes down well here. In fact, the French presidential election is coming up in April, as I mentioned, and the left-wing candidate, the socialist, they're laughingly called socialists over here, nothing to do with Soviet socialism. The socialists are saying publicly they can't wait to win this election so they can turn the clock back to where it was before Sarkozy became president. Because Sarkozy has tried to introduce more practical, productive ways and had a slogan at the beginning of his term that said, work harder and earn more. Well, that just sounds too American to the French, and they never liked it. And they're probably going to kick out Sarkozy because of his excessive Americanism. They want to go back to a more of a cocoon where they are sheltered by the welfare state and the what's called the nanny state. They want the state to take care of them, and that can only end badly. So I'm not very optimistic about the next couple of years over here.
You mentioned one relationship between individualism and the company, and that very in a great details described in your book. And indeed, some of it is quite complex because to simplify this, an individual has rights to express his or her own opinion and maximize his and her own efforts. In fact, Victor Borge used to say, if you an individual, but if you learn something new, don't get upset. there is, I think, a search in the world to find this invisible balance where indeed socialistic relationships where one for all and all for one can respect and encourage an individual enterprise. This is terribly difficult and very sensitive issues. In fact, in the United States now with education and with other issues, which perhaps can be addressed in another program. But coming back to your book and make this leap from the introduction to the end of the book, I have to say that I was impressed by the very two chapters, and correct me if I'm wrong, I felt that this is a very clear, I should say wise, description of American mentality where you're talking about taking charge of a traditional French company where indeed the management should convince the employees of a dying company to conform to another mentality, to another culture, for the benefits of their own survival, their own progress, and ultimately saving their company. So I'd like for you to comment on those two chapters, and then we will have some other conclusive thoughts, which I hope we will have enough time to elaborate on.
Well, I'm trying to grasp which chapters are we talking about here.
We're talking about very last two and chapters. One has the name "How to Seduce a Progressive French Staff."
Oh, yes. Okay. I see what you mean.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the second one, very, very last one, take charge of a traditional French company.
Right. I try to draw those two profiles in contrasting terms, Lena, because there are two ways you can approach management in this country. And one is being American style, almost military style, and manage in a top-down manner. And for that, you have to talk tough. You have to almost threaten people and show your muscle. Whereas the contrasting way, and the way that is probably less violent and less uncomfortable for everybody would be the second example, which is taking charge of a traditional, how to seduce a progressive French staff. That's the better way of the two. In other words, a true international manager would know enough about France to be able to seduce a progressive French staff. And the first thing he or she has to do is to become one of them. Whereas the second example is Mr. Tough Guy from Chicago who comes to Paris and says, now here's what we're going to do. I'm going to, you'd better take orders or get out. And what he will discover ultimately is that he doesn't really have the power to execute orders like that. Because what he will discover very fast is French employment law protects the worker to a much, much greater degree than in the U.S. So it's even difficult to change your management team or to reduce your staff or replace non-cooperative or unproductive employees. There are ways to, once a person is being told that it's all over, there are ways this individual can work with worker committees to contest the decision to push him out the door. Or if that fails, then there's an external judicial procedure also where the individual can either argue for reinstatement or walk away with a handsome sum of money. And I often saw this, even people who worked for me, when I decided there was no future for him or her in the company, the management above me would make a deal with the departing person to take 6 months' pay or something outlandish like that so that he or she would go away peacefully. That just doesn't happen in the States. I'm sorry. I worked for McGraw-Hill for a long time, and there is a procedure there, a 3 month period of warnings and performance evaluation, but that's usually just to satisfy the letter of the law. Usually, when someone is on 3 months' notice, he or she is heading for a dismissal. And yet the procedure allegedly is supposed to help the person improve his performance and reintegrate into the team. Well, in France, if the one reason staff can be cut is for economic reasons. If a company just can't continue to function with so many staff, then there is also a procedure for paying off departing employees. And I often heard employees who were leaving my team say, well, I have a nice bundle of cash from management, and the French welfare state will also pay me 2 years of something like 75% of my salary. So I'm going to write a book, or I'm going to go to the movies, or I'm going to go to Spain for a few weeks. So this leads to a really soft attitude toward work that we just can't afford anymore. And part of the problem is globalization, where there's just too much competition now. And if you're not up to the job, it makes no sense to keep a person on the payroll. It's a completely different way of looking at management-employee relations. And the truth is, I wrote this book to help Anglo-Saxon managers, the British are very much like the Americans, to help non-French managers who thought it would be a good idea to go to Paris and run a company for a while. This book is actually intended as a warning, or what you used, a term you used earlier, like a wake-up call to the naive American who maybe had a very good time on the Riviera on vacation 10 years ago and wants to recreate that aura. This book says, stop right there. That's not going to happen. Because once you slide inside the French economy, it's a different world.
Even though it's not terribly optimistic last phrase of yours, however, I tell you what is optimistic.
Lena, I'm a Francophile.
Oh, you... No, you did.
I just don't want to work for a French company.
Yeah. We did not hear that comment, but however, I have to conclude this program. I'm so thrilled that we could go over time because we had you had your voice, your presence a little later. So I just wanted to thank you for two things. One is that you found the time in your such a busy writing, thinking, and moving schedule. But number two, for the fact that you are so generously clear on those very complicated differences in the world. Again, the expression goes, we need more people like yourself. And I would add that we certainly expecting more writing, more learning from you. I personally, all listeners, wishing you the most of the, not only success, but endless amount of fruitful years to express yourself, to help us to understand world better. Michael, thank you so much.
Can I have 1 minute to say, Lena, I have huge admiration for you because you have come from a completely different world and integrated yourself into a new society and even created a radio show. I find it just staggeringly wonderful to see how you have survived and flourished. I'm sure it hasn't been easy, and I'm sure you could write a book about America just as interesting as mine about France.
With your help.
Okay, we've got a deal.
Fantastic. Well, I certainly would not say, in fact, I would say à bientôt.
Merci et à bientôt.
And bye-bye. Avec plaisir.
Okay, до скорого свидания.
До скорого вам свидания.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.